Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Chuck Morse Speaks, the podcast. Welcome to the program. This is your host, Chuck Morse. We will be joined shortly by Alana Mercer. Alana is a columnist with WorldNet Daily. She hosts The Trump Revolution, The Donald's Creative Destruction, Deconstructed. Thank you very much. And Alana refers to herself on the website of being alanamercer.com as a libertarian author, columnist, and blogger. And, of course, we'll be discussing the political phenomena of Donald Trump. Alana, thanks for joining me this afternoon. And you are on the air. Thanks for joining me, Alana.
Hello?
Okay, speak up when you can. Hi, yes, we're on the air. Thank you very much, Alana.
I'm on a landline, so a little backwards
okay.
Here.
Well, that's fine. You're now live with me on the podcast. So I am looking at your website, and I see that your website is entitled The Trump Revolution, The Donald's Creative Destruction Deconstructed. You're a columnist with WorldNet Daily. Let's
mm-hmm.
go right to a conversation about the phenomena of Donald Trump. He is facing, obviously, a serious challenge tomorrow in the Wisconsin primary, although I've seen polls showing that the race is tightening. What do you make of this unusual and really quite unprecedented candidacy?
Well, I will be the author of the forthcoming Trump Revolution. It's out in June. So I'm going to just give you a teaser and not spoil the mystery of it. As you said, the entire title is The Donald's Creative Destruction Deconstructed. And my last book was Into the Cannibals Pot. As you know, I write the longest-standing exclusive paleo-libertarian column for WorldNet Daily. Briefly, plays into my perspective on Trump. Paleo-libertarianism, all five paleolibs that we are, hold all those magnificent positions that we admire in, well, maybe not all of us admire in the light libertarians of reason or Cato or the Cato faction, with an important distinction. Paleolibertarians realize that liberty has a civilizational dimension. Crudely put, it's associated with a certain Western culture, tradition, religion. Even more crudely put, once America becomes a minority-dominated country where the founding people are in a minority, it will become a dominant party state, like South Africa. And liberty is pretty much kaput. So those elements in my thinking definitely play into my perception of the Trump phenomenon, and it is. He is smashing a political spoil system like we've never seen. You know, the media complex, the party complex, the pseudo-phony conservative complex. And my perspective in this forthcoming book is that in the age of unconstitutional government, I think we both agree, Democratic or Republican, and in fact the Republican base agrees, you know, we live under unconstitutional government. What did Mark Levine call it? Post-constitutional era, right? So the process of creative destruction can only increase the freedom quotient. So basically that's the impetus of the book. And unlike Chucky Krauthammer, the neoconservative, I began documenting the Trump rise ever since he announced. And my columns are pretty predictive. You know, I stick to, I cleave to the truth. I analyze and deconstruct as close to reality. I don't err on the side of wish fulfillment, which is what the neocons have done, right? They wish he'll go away, therefore they say he'll go away. So that's
Everyone, they've all been quite wrong. Yeah, and they're all lining up against him at this point. I've never seen anything like it. It's not just the liberal Dems, but it's the establishment Republicans, and I've never seen anything more vitriolic. I mean, the left is obviously playing the usual card that they play against anyone who threatens their authoritarian position. I mean, they try to examine the weaknesses as they see it. In the case back 4 years ago of Mitt Romney, they attacked him for being successful. This is the proof that he didn't care about people, and they worked the class dialectic. Now they're attacking Donald Trump mainly because they claim that he has got something against black men and women. He's got something against various ethnic men and women, of course, which is a big lie. But they're trying to get that to stick, and they don't care over the fact that they're basically throwing kerosene on what already exists in this country, which is racial conflict.
But Chuck, isn't it interesting that the discourse between the Republicans and the Democrats, the smart set, I call it, isn't that different? The respectable right, those that, unlike you and me, make it onto those panels, you know, those duo panels bobbing heads, you know, they all socialize with one another, and they are the smart set. And as the right has converged with the left, we see very little difference in the attacks on Trump. And that really is what the base, I think, is intuitively and actually magnificently picking up on, that these are two sides of, you know, two wings of the same bird of prey, as one wag once put it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
you talk about libertarianism in a way that is very more succinct than I've heard. And I think that in line with that, Donald Trump could be described as an American revolutionary. And when I say that, I point to the American Revolution itself, which was a conservative revolution. I mean, the American people and their leaders at that time not only wanted to conserve our liberty, which had been usurped by the king and parliament, but we wanted to reestablish our rights to local government, representative government, which the king had taken away, our right to create our own currency, our right to live wherever we chose. The king had said you can't go into the Ohio Valley, our right to free trade in goods and services, you know, our right to taxation based upon what our representatives would determine was best, and all, you know, which is a blow against the big government authoritarians. And Trump is basically saying that today. It's a reassertion of American constitutional rights. And people are not used to it because he comes at it from such a refreshing voice. It's not the usual phony British accents that we hear from these smart people, you know, who sit around and they're very droll. Trump is very blunt, and he basically, you know, sometimes maybe a little too blunt for some of our tastes.
Yeah. I don't think he's ever too blunt. I don't think he's ever too blunt. Bring it on, you know.
Yeah, no, I know, me too. But, you know, the thing that, if anything is accomplished from the Trump candidacy, is that he really has stuck a pin in the political correctness tyranny. You know, people are afraid of being charged with this ugly and preposterous accusation that they have something against black men and women. And particularly, you know, he's exposed the fact that this is part of the weapon of the left to use only against their opponents. Obviously,
exactly. This
is a big lie.
And
he's
constitutionally incapable of playing this game. It's alien to him, and so it should for any normal, healthy thinking and rational individual, because these concepts of collective guilt and racism are a cultural Marxism at its worst. And the interesting thing is that these concepts have been adopted by conservatives completely. There's no difference in the debate. You know, the left will argue, you know, that they will stick to all these politically correct strictures that you can't, you know, debate. They'll debate sexism and racism and ageism in speech, but mainstream conservatives seldom recuse themselves from this act of policing, this Orwellian act of policing speech. You know, I mean, I have an example in one of my columns where Cornell Williams Brooks, a radical leftist from the National Association of the Advancement of Colored People, and S.E. Cupp, that unsharpened pencil, so-called conservative, both accusing Trump of otherizing people. Now, since when do conservatives talk in such obscurantist, idiotic language. No, we don't believe in collective guilt. Basically, the attitude of the new conservatives, the neocons, and the liberals is that, well, pat on the head, whites have come along, you know, have come a long way, you know, just keep at it. But we still have
you know,
a long way to go.
It's an amazing thing. I mean, you're elaborating on what we've seen over the last at least two elections, probably even going way back, and that is that the predominant discussion, and the conservatives have also been, I don't want to use the word brainwashed, but I think that it's that we've eternalized many of these ideas without being conscious of it. This idea of viewing politics and people collectively, that, you know, they talk about, well, the woman is running against the African-American, who's running against the Hispanic, who's running against the Asian, and, you know, and this and that, and everybody is supposed to think that this actually has a great import. And, you know, Trump's, again, I mean, he stuck a pin in it. I think that even John McCain in 2009 stuck a little pin in it when he picked Sarah Palin as his running mate. All this buildup that went on for a year constantly, we have to have a woman in office, a woman this, woman that, as if this
but,
is something
Chuck,
that's going to be...
old conservatives, as I consider myself a classical liberal of the 19th century type, the old right wouldn't dignify these artificial concepts. These are postmodern cultural Marxist concepts. They are alien.
Yeah.
They should be alien to conservative talk. We are individualists. And it's interesting, and I think the Republican Party base actually senses it viscerally. They might not be able to articulate it intellectually, and maybe
uh-huh.
Trump doesn't, but viscerally they sense that it's so wrong, you know, that we live in a... The population has been propagandized, and a sizable segment has concluded that conservative power brokers, in their language and in their practices as politicians, don't differ much from liberal power brokers. And I think this is quite marvelous.
Yeah.
I just and hope that...
Okay, my guest
mm-hmm.
is Alana Mercer. The website is alanamercer.com. She's a libertarian author, columnist, blogger. She writes regularly for WorldNet Daily. She calls herself a paleo libertarian. Alana, you know, I think that also in a very visceral way and even in a subconscious way, while Trump is waking people up to the true nature of our politics, he is appealing to a huge cross-section of people. And he has noted this himself. Even
exactly.
The head of the SEIU, which is a very ultra-liberal left union,
mm-hmm.
has gone on the record that, much to his dismay, he's discovered that a large percentage of his rank and file are supporting Trump. People are supporting Trump, but they're doing so quietly because the attack against him and against his followers is
yeah.
so ferocious and so bitter and so vicious. It's unlike anything probably that I
Nothing.
Have seen going all the way back to the attack on Senator Joseph McCarthy. I mean, this is a complete attempt to not only stop this candidate, but destroy him.
Yeah.
And he just
and how,
keeps
and,
going.
And
I mean,
how
it's
strong.
Amazing.
Yeah, and how strong must an individual be to withstand this? I would not be able to. Would you?
No, I mean, Trump just seems to, you know, he's almost seems, I don't know what the man eats for breakfast, but I sure would like
you know,
to try it.
Chuck, wouldn't you think that this is the country craves manliness? That's another thesis in my book.
Interesting
you know?
Observation.
Yeah, these,
Trump
you know,
kind of
and
the old
frankly,
of what masculinity used to be. It used to be something that
absolutely.
Was honest.
Absolutely. He is a bulldog and he's a fighter and he's undeterred and he's unapologetic about, he's toned down his manliness, namely, oh, he embraces anger. Oh my God, what a terrible emotion to embrace. Mm-hmm. His Twitter handle doesn't describe his husband to Heidi, which is Cruz, the feminized. A candidate.
Right.
All our candidates have been house trained by females, and this guy. I mean, I can't imagine President Trump, describing himself as Melania's husband. It would be president of the greatest country in the world. Bite me, you know. So
of course,
absolutely.
What
so this
know,
is
though,
manliness.
I guess, Alana, that brings up one of these statistics I see floating around regularly and constantly being trumpeted, and I don't know where they came up with it, but it says that polls indicate that 70% of women do not support Trump, and that women are becoming uncomfortable with Trump because of comments. I mean, and one thing that Trump, I mean, and I think Trump has made some pretty big mistakes there. I mean, I don't think it was really necessary for him to tweet out a picture of his wife next to that.
That's a little cruel. I don't think it's
women.
You know, I cannot speak as a woman, and frankly, I would give up my vote if females would be denied the vote too, because there's definitely my tongue is not firmly embedded in my cheek, but the female franchise has definitely been associated with an increase in socialized policies on state level, municipal, etc. And there's no, I think our friend Mr. Lott, Dr. Lott, documents that extensively, and so there's no question. So I do worry about the female vote and the feminized media that absolutely disdains and works against Trump. As a woman, I think of myself as an individualist. I can't answer that question. It's too alien to me.
Of course. Mm-hmm. But yet, you know, Trump also answers the question himself in a very individualist style, which I think hopefully people are going to get, and that is, of course he's good for women for the same reason he's good for men. He wants to have a strong defense against terrorists infiltrating into the country.
Mm-hmm.
He wants
mm-hmm.
to stop criminals and rapists, you know, undocumented people who might be involved with crime. He wants to sort of see if there's a way we can, you know, properly document people, which is also good for women. And the third thing is he's an entrepreneur. He wants to lower taxes and develop an economy so that women and men can succeed. You know, that to me is such a great answer. I don't know if people in this day and age are going to be thinking on their own enough to know why that's a great answer.
I think they sense, the Republican base especially, sense that the incentives that undergird his candidacy are completely different to the rest. And I think as a libertarian, we do dissect the incentives, the disincentives in government. What makes mm-hmm. government so corrupt? I mean, failure is associated with more funding. Trump is running a quintessential, tight, business-oriented campaign, and his incentives are completely inversely related to those of his compatriots, his competitors. The political animal is different from an individual who's self-motivated, self-funded, and coming at it from love of country. And these are things that are also themes in The Trump Revolution, my forthcoming book. And I don't think people do understand this enough, because they don't understand the difference between private property, you know, when you own the means of production, when you own your company, you are going to be very, very frugal and judicious in the way you invest scarce resources. In government, we don't have scarce resources. How does government get its funding? Through taxing, printing, and borrowing. It doesn't. There's no concept of preservation and conservation in government. So he's running a very conservative, financially conservative, and these are incentives that are, you know, people don't grasp them because they're not taught economics 101.
No, I mean, they don't, you know, it's idiotic in a way that there would even be a discussion today about the importance of private ownership and property. I mean, this is a concept that exists in the animal kingdom. You know, it's natural to the human being. If you try to interfere with a bird's nest, you know, you're going to get in trouble. If you interfere with a beaver's dam or a lion's den, or even your pet dog, if somebody goes too close to a dog, you know, in their territory. I mean, animals understand what property is. I mean, this is something that's inherent. It's not even, you know, the fact that this would be, you know, demonized today, I think that should tell us everything we need to know. Which gets me to my question here, Alana. What do you make of the Bernie Sanders phenomena? Here you have an open, avowed socialist.
Yeah.
And he is attracting, I mean, what is going on with our particularly younger people, have they been that dumbed down that they don't ask? I mean, I've asked people this who say to me, gee, I'm supporting Bernie Sanders. And I asked them, I said, well, do you think that it is a good thing, idea for this country to go towards socialism? And they scratch their heads. They haven't really thought about it. They don't know what that even means.
It's very dismaying, very, very dismaying. Socialism is anathema, is alien in America, used to be until the 60s and the 70s when, there was a large sort of kind of coup. It happened actually with immigration from East Europe, the great influxes of socialist thinking intellectuals who took over the intellectual means of production, namely the think tanks, the publishing houses,
right,
tertiary, secondary education. And socialism is not being taught, and Marxism is not being taught. And the evil of it, I think the Black Book of Communism is an absolute must textbook, because it associates,
yep,
you know, the default position is, oh, it means well, it doesn't work very well in practice. But no, the underlying ideology is evil, and it causes and intentionally results in mass death. And so these associations have not been made for kids, you know. I mean, when people say the kids, I mean, John Kasich doesn't stop whining about the kids. I mean, that's another hallmark of the feminized culture. You know, I say, you'll have to bleep me, but I'll say, F the kids, adult lives matter. And the kids are pretty much a write-off these days, because
Marx himself mentioned in the Communist Manifesto that the public control of education, that the movement is going to start with the manipulation of the children, and that's
absolutely,
and also it's young people, the teens of college age, and that particular age group that has always been attracted to authoritarian movements, whether it be Nazism, which is of course socialism, or whether it be communism. They want to have some easy explanation for existence. They are taught to reject belief in a creator of the universe, particularly through Darwinism.
Yeah.
And they're therefore looking to replace that with some kind of a dear leader, some sort of a great earthly savior, if you will, whether it be Barack Obama or someone else, who is going to give them the meaning that has been drummed out of their lives.
You know who gave the best explanation for this, the easiness with which people adopt, young people especially, adopt socialism? It was Milton Friedman in the introduction to Hayek's, one of Hayek's, was it the Road to Serfdom?
Road to Serfdom,
And he said, do you remember what he said, Milton Friedman? He said there that socialism appeals to emotions. It is an emotional argument. And freedom and individualism and the attendant system of capitalism that comports with liberty, these are highly sophisticated rational arguments. And it's true, you cannot, I mean, our founders warned that when you lose the intellect, when you lose your ability to think, you know, liberty goes by the way. And that's one of the things that Milton Friedman did highlight for me, that socialism is visceral, emotional. Freedom is a complex argument. It's rational.
Yeah, and it's also a group mentality, which can be fun when you're a young person, especially looking for a mate.
exactly.
You know, Road to Serfdom, you mentioned, by Hayek. He won a Nobel Prize for that book. It's mainly an economic analysis, but it also brings up a seminal point, which is, and he lived this, which was that Nazism and communism are, the difference between them is more cosmetic than real. And that Nazism was viewed, and rightfully, as a progressive leftist movement right up until the 1941 betrayal by Hitler of his ally Stalin when he invaded Russia. I mean, before that, they were allies. People need to understand that the American left back then, I mean the hard left, you know, the Communist Party, their fellow travelers, these people were pro-Hitler during the first 2 years of World War II. I mean, because
that,
you know, it was
Chuck, sorry, we're so comfortable with saying, with maligning fascism and maligning Hitler, and so he should be, but he was really quite cuddly compared to Mao and Stalin and Pol Pot. And I really do recommend that young people delve into the Black Book of Communism, which is written by scholars. Have you read that book?
Oh, yeah, I've read in it. It's two French intellectuals. It was actually translated into English by the Harvard Press.
Mm.
And it, as you say, it documents to the T the atrocities of communist dictatorships, starting with Lenin, and right up through. And since we're on the topic, we have a minute here. We should note that Lenin had already slaughtered upwards of 5 million people before Hitler even joined the Nazi Party. I mean, that the Leninists in 1918 had already established. Yeah, I mean, they'd established the Gulag system, which was imitated by the Nazis with their concentration camps, and they established the Cheka, which
and
was
by
the police, which was imitated by the Gestapo.
Yeah, by the way, ISIS beheadings were begun in the early 1900s after the revolution. They would behead people, they would drown them, and the total casualties of socialism, communism, over 100 million.
Which
makes Hitler, as I said, small potatoes by comparison.
Hitler was not as far to the left. He was radical left for Germany. It was the most radically leftist regime Germany's ever experienced. But compared to Stalin, it was. You see, the only way you could say that Nazism is on the right is because it was to the right of Stalin.
I think the other point to make is people who just hunkered down, Germans who hunkered down during Hitler's reign, were able to go about their lives and eke out. They were not under assault all the time. Under Stalin, every single individual, whether you said something like this, we were talking about political correctness and cultural Marxism and what you can say and what you can't and policing, you would find yourself rounded up if you said something. So no individual, and we know that he killed the farmers and he killed the intellectuals and no individual, thought crimes, the kind that conservatives are so happy adjudicating, were what brought regular individuals down. And in Hitler's Germany, it was quite possible, as many people said, oh, I didn't know about the concentration camps, because that was the reality. You were able to go about your business. Mm-hmm. And that was the difference as well in life under communism as opposed
That's
to life
right.
under Hitler.
Well, I just think it should be emphasized that socialism is a matter of degrees. And with regard to that, Nazism was radically on the left, but it wasn't as radical as communism. Both of them came from the same root. The whole anti-Semitic experience in Nazi Germany was a leftist thing. I mean, the Holocaust was a leftist experiment. You can read Marx's infamous pamphlet on the Jewish question to understand that when Marx attacked the Jews, he attacked them for being capitalists. He attacked them.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Exactly.
Anyway, Alana, we're reaching toward the end of the program, so I want to give you the opportunity to let my listeners and followers know where they can find out more about you and about your work.
Thank you so much, Chuck. It was lovely chatting to you. Well, my forthcoming book is The Trump Revolution, The Donald's Creative Destruction Deconstructed, and they can follow the publishing date will be June, and that will be on ilanamercer.com. And I'm a long-standing columnist for WorldNet Daily. I write the exclusive paleo-libertarian column, have done so for 15 years. So they can find me on ilanamercer.com or WorldNet Daily.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to reading it and having you back.
I'd love to. And
your commentary as we move through the election. Thank you again. Thank you, Alana.
Thank you for having me on. Bye-bye.
It's my pleasure. Okay, so that kind of wraps things up for the podcast today. This is Chuck Morse. My books are available at Amazon.com. Just look it up under Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code, and you will see over 10 nonfiction books come up, and there they are. I want to thank you again for listening today. I'm looking forward tomorrow night to the Wisconsin primary. I hope Donald does it. And again, thanks so much, everybody. Have a nice day.